Happy Thanksgiving and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host, and thanks so much for taking this time to be with us on Thanksgiving. Maybe you're driving, maybe you're recovering from some conspicuous consumption, or maybe you're just relaxing on a Thanksgiving afternoon and or evening, or maybe day after Thanksgiving morning if you're on the other side of the dateline. But in that case, did you even celebrate Thanksgiving? Because it's an American holiday. We're glad you're here, whatever the case may be, and we decided, let's just do a great show for Thanksgiving because it's so nice that people would
as take a change of pace.
Yeah, as a switch up. Anyway, we can cut that mic. Here with us for the flannel panel, we're
going to do. I'm supposed to wait till I'm introduced.
Yes, you are. That's Chris Check, president of Catholic Answers.
Hi, thank you for having me on your show, Cy.
Thank you for having me have a show, yeah. Chris. And also with us, Joe Heschmeyer, apologist and writer extraordinaire. Hello, Joe Heschmeyer.
Hi. Good to be here.
And the reason we call it the flannel panel is we all wear flannel
while we're doing this. Except that's not true.
Well, generally we do, unless one person forgets to bring their flannel to the office and tries to slip in a plaid shirt.
That's
and
your
pretend.
Shirt. That's not.
Nobody noticed until you said it.
Wait, how
Chris.
Could you not notice? Everyone's noticing right now.
Did anybody notice it wasn't a flannel
it's plaid.
Shirt?
No. It's not flannel. And then I was very disturbed to learn in the conversation before the program that Joe Heschmeyer said he didn't know the difference between plaid and flannel. And
his wife dressed him, well, I think, because he's wearing flannel.
I appreciate that. But I thought, here's a man capable of extraordinary theological distinctions.
Yeah.
And yet flat and panel seem to have eluded him.
Well,
flat and plannel.
You know,
flat
I went out that Einstein flat, regularly flat forgot flannel. To wear socks with his shoes.
What's that? Say that again, Joe.
Einstein regularly forgot to wear socks with his shoes. You know, you got to choose which things you spend your mental energy on. This is this famous, like, Steve Jobs always wearing a black turtleneck thing. It was just him saying, I got better things to worry about.
So I just want to say the three greatest people of the 20th century, Einstein, Steve Jobs, and Joe Heschmeyer, apparently.
Right.
I'm not exclusively 20th century.
I kind of feel like Einstein gets quoted as an authority on more things than he actually is.
Right. He was a great authority on physics.
Yeah, I guess, if you're into that relativity stuff.
If you're into that reality.
Well, he had a distinctive sartorial style, I'd say.
He was a charming figure as well. He cut a charming figure. The flannel panel is where we take time. In this case, 2 hours. We're going to do a two-hour flannel panel. And we talk about the news of the world from a Catholic perspective and focusing particularly on those things most related to the church. So there'll be some particularly church news, some world news, all of that. But the main thing is just to celebrate Thanksgiving today. Do either of you have anything that you're thankful for today? I'm thankful for you, Joe. Well,
I do, but I actually came with a story you might be thankful for in a second here.
Oh, okay.
So My parents were with my aunt, who is a religious sister, a Benedictine sister, at a mass with the archbishop. And afterwards, they're talking to the archbishop, and he says, I enjoy hearing Joe Heschmeyer on Catholic Answers occasionally. And my aunt, who, again, is a religious sister, says, yeah, sorry about the other times.
Good for her. Good for her. I like her. I'm very thankful for her.
I thought Sy'll enjoy that humor. Yeah.
What's her name in religious life?
Let's get her on the show.
Sister Jane Heschmeyer, yeah.
Sister Jane. Love Sister Jane.
Yeah, her claim to fame. She is one of the two, they co-invented the gluten-free host.
Oh, really?
So she and another sister. Yeah, so. And the Benedictine Sisters of Perpetual Adoration in Clyde, Missouri. She was one of the two sisters who experimented with recipes till they found something that had enough wheat to meet the requirements that it be truly wheat without having enough gluten to trigger celiac. So
does she make them?
They did. They actually stopped during COVID.
Until this one Irish guy pretty much took over all of the production of hosts in the country.
Yeah, there's
heard
a fascinating
about that,
story about that, actually.
It is?
Yeah, it's sad because now it's mass-produced by like a company in Massachusetts. Hosts were produced by religious sisters, yep. And this was a real labor of love.
It's very difficult to find hosts baked by nuns.
It's funny because when I was a kid, I remember asking my grandmother, where the hosts come from, and she told me about the nuns who baked them. So I always assumed.
I think it's possible. We should find out who does and then promote them on the air.
But let's not get all too down because we're in the midst of what we're thankful for. And you guys went right to, the nuns have it so hard now because they can't cook hosts anymore. I am thankful for Sister Jane. I'm very thankful for her. Chris, do you have anything that you're thankful for?
I could take the next 2 hours, son.
Yeah, you could.
I'm grateful for the whole staff of Catholic Answers. I'm grateful for God's trust in me and the support and the trust that all our supporters put in us to spread the gospel. What a great gift to make a living sharing the truth.
It really is. Yeah, I share that.
If I could maybe build off that and just that spirit of gratitude, and to be like in a place where you get to use the gifts and skills you have in a way that you feel like glorifies God and is fun to do,
yes,
is such a sweet spot to really hit all of that stuff.
Do you think that's how Joseph felt as a carpenter? Like, I think that's how Joseph probably felt.
Of course,
like,
he did.
Like, he probably loved working and what, because he knew it gave glory to God, and he made these whatever he was making
really high quality stuff.
I don't know. Was he?
No, I'm sure it was very good.
He could have been a framer.
Did you just say, I don't know?
Well, I mean, I know it was high quality for what he's doing, but I don't know what his job was. Like,
he was a very good carpenter. It's in the Bible.
Yeah, they make the stuff to sell in the back of church.
Sorry, Joe, I interrupted you.
But no, it's okay. I was going to say, I've got a new podcast coming out December 1st, Shameless Popery, and it's been a blast to get to do that. And there are just these times when you're doing that where you just think, like, yeah, this is my job. Like, I'm getting paid to do this thing I would probably do for free. I mean, I don't want to say that too loud in front of Chris, but
I know that's the thing. You've got to be careful when Chris is around.
I am so thankful that Joe wants to work for free. This is great news.
I know. His children don't want him to work for free,
I
want to
say
though.
That I'm thankful for my beautiful wife of 31 years and my 4 magnificent sons. And both of my parents are still alive.
I have that same thing to be thankful for.
They're approaching 90.
Isn't that great to be our age?
And they're
in you're
extraordinary shape.
Yeah.
I'm thankful for my brothers, Edward and Paul. Paul, of course, Father Paul, who runs the shrine. The list could go on. I would like to recommend to everyone listening to get good at saying thank you for bad news.
Okay, tell me about
and
that.
And I have a piece.
That's
on the website today that I wrote, and that the great Drew Belsky, for whom I'm also very thankful for, turned into readable prose.
Very nice.
But we have to get in the practice of saying thank you for bad news. This is in St. Paul. It builds our character.
Well, I have a car that's building my character all the time.
Well, more than that, God uses iniquities to bring about greater goods, and we need to say thank you. Here's one more thought about thank you. Please read my column, folks, at Catholic.com today. Our prayers here are petition, I'm sorry, I love you, and thank you. But there's not going to be any more petition and I'm sorry on the other side of the veil. It's all going to be I love you and thank you. So I recommend we all start practicing on this side of the veil the prayer that we're going to be saying on the other side, God willing, and that's thank you.
I'm still stuck in I'm sorry.
You know what? So Blessed Solanus Casey said,
if you want to practice on us, we'll receive that.
Blessed Solanus Casey said, gratitude is the sign of a rational person, or the first sign of a rational person.
Yeah.
The happiest people in the room are the most grateful.
Oh, that's definitely true. Gratitude gratitude in a certain sense is happiness. And this is what worries me about the way we raise children now. And I'm not criticizing parents or anything. It's just that there's so, I think media has a tendency to make you ungrateful because you're just seeing wonders and miracles constantly on media, and life then has a hard time measuring up. And it's hard to raise children who grow up to be adults who are just truly grateful for what they have and not a little bit disappointed in how it all
turned
out.
Yeah, this is a problem in the Catholic media, as you know, the Catholic online world. It excites so much of the irascible passions. And it's not that we need to ignore the crises or that we need to be grateful for the crises as such, but that we do need to say thank you to God for what he will do with these iniquities, as I say, because he brings about greater good. G.K. Chesterton, for whom our studio is named, says, gratitude is the highest form of thought. Wow.
Wow, that's beautiful. Yeah, so what I'm hearing you guys say are really two things. One, it sounded like Cy was kind of pointing to the way there can be a numbing effect, that when you're so used to everything being amazing all the time, you know, just to take one example, think about how long we used to wait for a web page to load compared to how long we'll wait for a web page to load now. Like if it takes more than, I don't know,
that's funny.
5 seconds,
yeah.
This I'm is already funny. On to the next thing.
We just updated our service at the checkhouse because it was
so
horribly
slow.
Yeah.
But you remember that when you first got on AOL or something and it started downloading an article? It was like, where are they downloading this from, Apollo 11? And yeah, you're right.
And so, you know, I mean, I see it even in my kids where their ability to recognize things as being really magical, I think, is impacted because everything around them, it's like they're growing up in Narnia. Like the number of things around you that can do things that were unthinkable even a generation ago when I was growing up. It's really, I had not noticed how different their childhood and mine was until I actually started to, you know, have kids of my own. That it's a shocking chasm. And that's not, like, we try to limit very extreme limits on how much media they consume of any kind, but just walking around, you see things that would have been jaw-dropping 20 years ago, 30 years ago.
Right.
And I can only imagine for you guys. But
that was not very nice.
Yeah, I remember when young people respected their elders, for example, right?
Right. I don't like the word elder. I don't like. No, but it is true.
I believe your generation gave us, like, my generation and all that whole, like, let's not respect our elders anymore.
No, spirit, that was actually the generation before us.
Good point.
We're on the tail end of that. But because I can I mean, anybody my age can remember the first time they saw a cell phone. You know, like like it was the first cell phone that anybody in their house had seen. And now you get mad if, you know, like if I'm driving home and I got an hour commute and I'm trying to listen to the Celtics game in Boston on my iPhone, it's like I'm mad if it glitches on me. Well, how did that happen? Yeah. How did I go from the miracle of the new cell phone to I missed 1 minute of the Celtics?
You know, Chesterton gives another insight here because he describes gratitude as happiness doubled by wonder. So there's an element of there has to be an element of wonder, I think, and as more and more seemingly miraculous things are so readily available to us, our capacity for wonder is diminished.
Yeah, I do think getting children out into nature is one cure for that.
So important,
and also being very tolerant of your children being bored. Just when they don't cure boredom,
right?
Yeah. Allow them to cure boredom.
Yes. There's a fascinating, I was reading an article, I can no longer tell you where it was, that was tracing the history of the idea of boredom. That boredom is a very modern phenomenon. Because to feel boredom, you have to be in this mode of being a passive recipient. You know, because if you aren't, if you're in the position of someone who can think and someone who can create, to say you're bored is just to say you don't have any ideas. It's a self-indictment. But now we say we're bored because we wanted to sit back and have somebody else perform for us.
Yeah, no one's entertaining me currently. How can that be?
And boredom is a function of a lack of gratitude. I'm not grateful for what I currently have, but I know that that other thing that's just around the corner, whether it's on the channel, on the remote control, or the web browser, or the new car, whatever it is, this is the thing that's going to bring me fulfillment. So I think a lack of gratitude contributes to boredom.
Yeah, but the experience of nature, I think, as a child, builds the soul. I mean, God made nature to communicate himself to us. And
yes.
if you have those, you know, moments in the summer where you're just, I don't know, watching the leaves move in the wind or something, then that the soul is built by that.
I know we get a lot, not a lot, but from time to time, someone will say, well, why is Catholic Answers in Southern California? Well, this is where Carl Keating put us, and before him, Junipero Serra, if you will. But I'm grateful to live in Southern California, where just right close to us is 9,000 acres of nature there in Mission Trails Regional Park, and go climb a mountain at lunch.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
extraordinary.
Yeah, and when we're talking about being spoiled, Southern California, it's unbelievable. You can go from the beach to the mountain in less time than maybe anywhere else in the country. Yeah,
and you can
a beautiful beach and beautiful mountains and great weather. And
between the beach and the mountains are 40 of the best Mexican restaurants you've ever been to in your life. I got to take. So I'm going to say that I'm grateful for Mexican restaurants. We will be back right after this for more of the Thanksgiving Flannel Panel with Joe and Chris right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
The destination for great Catholic audio programming is EWTN Podcast Central, featuring the best of EWTN radio, as well as faith-filled podcasts from our friends and affiliates across the nation, all in one place, all free. If it's central to the faith, you can find it on EWTN Podcast Central. It's like podcast heaven. Visit EWTN.com/radio/podcasts today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's the Flannel Panel. Joe Heschmeyer, Chris Check here with us. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. And basically, the way the Flannel Panel works is I gather up news stories and suggest them to them about what they would like to talk about. They then don't read them and are shocked by them when I present them to them on air. Are you guys ready to get to that portion of the show?
It keeps an air of authenticity.
Well, you do. You know, actually, Chris, I know Chris checked them. I don't know if you did, Chris,
okay,
Joe.
Okay, so wait. Can I just say in my defense and Joe's, I'm sure, you give these topics to us.
The night before. I gave them to you yesterday.
Okay, so I do have a couple of things to do from time to time.
Do you have things more important than Flannel Panel to do?
No.
What a beautiful lie. All right, Joe, you were going to say something. Sorry.
I was just going to check. So you sent that at 3:58 p.m. my time, just for the record. I had
That's 2 o'clock our time. I didn't make you move to Kansas or wherever you live.
Fair enough. No, on the realm of Thanksgiving, we'd be remiss if we didn't point out the standard Catholic talking point about Thanksgiving, which
Eucharist.
Is that this is what Eucharist means. Yeah. And I was really struck by this in reading the gospel. So I'm finishing up a manuscript on a new book on the Eucharist that'll be coming from Catholic Answers, I think, in spring. I don't know when.
And spring of 23.
Yes, spring of 23. That's good. Thank you. Oh, hopefully.
That means get to work, Joe. That's what he's saying.
I actually think the manuscript's complete, right, Joe?
It's like mostly done. Yeah. There's still some work.
Oh, that is.
I keep updating.
That's a writer's
but
answer.
But in John 6, it says it has this line where we talk about the multiplication of the loaves, and it says when he had given thanks. That's when he distributes the Eucharist. He distributes the multiplied loaves. But that when he had given thanks, those five English words are translating one Greek word, Eucharistissos, which is he Eucharitizes the bread by giving thanks for it. And so if you think about it that way, I think it ties back to what Chris said earlier, that Thanksgiving is that disposition of the soul that remains into eternity, because the Eucharist really prepares us for the wedding feast of the Lamb, which is a Eucharistic, a Thanksgiving kind of celebration. And so I say that not just to underscore the sacramental importance of the Eucharist, but also to underscore the spiritual disposition of Thanksgiving, that if we don't approach the Eucharist with Thanksgiving, and if we don't approach the Mass and the faith and our life with Thanksgiving, then we're not really preparing ourselves for heaven in the way we ought to be.
Amen, brother.
And God bless the Church in America, which has incorporated this secular holiday into the liturgical calendar. I hope everybody went to Mass today. It's not a day of obligation, but the American bishops saw fit to bring this into the church in America's liturgical calendar.
It is one of the best things about America.
And has special readings and everything.
Yeah, it does. It does.
It's a good day. I mean, a day to give thanks. And, You know, I think I'm sure that the opportunity to give thanks is missed a great deal. We probably all miss it. People really do give thanks on Thanksgiving. Like, that's a very common thing. Like, you're not at all surprised where if you're visiting somebody, even if you've been invited to with a group that, you know, oh, I'm kind of the odd person out here. They don't know me that well. You're never surprised when people give thanks on Thanksgiving. Even secular people give thanks. I don't know who they're giving thanks to, maybe to each other or just to the universe or whatever, but it's a beautiful thing to give thanks.
Yeah, so I think that's a good point. I think there's two points to make there. One is there's a real theological underpinning to Thanksgiving. Even though it's a secular holiday, it's a kind of secular holiday. It was, you know, a day of prayer established by the U.S. government. So it already had like a religious undertone, you know, when Lincoln makes it a federal holiday. But it really, I think Thanksgiving is sort of an incoherent holiday if you're an atheist. Because, again, like what you just said, Cy, to whom are you thanking?
Yeah.
But the other thing is I think Thanksgiving is a really important check against pride. Like, the way we often try to be humble is by pretending we don't have gifts that we have. And that's not humility, that's ingratitude. Like, if someone gives you a car and you say, oh, this car's a piece of junk, you're not being humble, you're being a jerk. And so likewise, when God gives you gifts and talents and you pretend like you don't have those, or you pretend like they're not very good or they're not as good as your neighbor's, you're not being humble there. That's not humility. But being thankful for the gifts and talents that you have and recognizing you didn't give them to yourself, that God gave them to you, that is humility. Because you still realize your radical dependency upon God at every turn and at every moment. And that really is, I have no talents on my own. I may have five by the grace of God. I have none on my own. It's actually true humility to realize just the truth about yourself rather than pretending that you've got a little less than God actually gave you.
Yeah. It can be a startling reality when you come up against your own contingency. I like, there's at some point in life when you realize if you kind of follow the gift of faith intellectually, you must come to a point where you go, I am utterly contingent upon God's will at every second, at every moment. Like, if His will were not to be certain, then my existence, everything I have would not be certain. And then I think that you work through that by realizing there's nothing more certain than the will of God. Like, He could put it in my hands and say, all right, it's up to you, you know, how or whether you exist. And I would not be as certain a rock as God is. And there's a reason to be grateful.
I think Joe's excellent insights here have given our listeners an opportunity for a little bit of personal reflection to think about what their talents are and to recognize them and then recognize that they came from God and then say, am I using these talents in his service, in the corporal and spiritual works of mercy? Can I say thank you for one more thing?
Yeah.
Our magazine editor, Tim Ryland, is marrying Dr. Sharon Frank on Saturday. I am so grateful for that wedding.
Right.
And I ask all of our listeners to pray for Tim and Sharon.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing, and she's a beautiful person.
She is. And he's a great guy.
Right. Well,
I think he got the better end of that.
You know, that's just obvious. I mean, we're all looking at that in amazement. But he definitely did. He would say, Tim, very humble.
He is. And very talented.
Yeah. Right. And I think we should embrace our talents. And I'm going to admit a talent that I have. I have a talent for the radio segue. So
I knew this was coming.
Is this like the thing that you ride on?
It's where you move from one topic to the next so smoothly that the audience doesn't even notice. That you have moved. It's a rare talent. So speaking of marriage...
sounds like I set you up there, Cy. Sounds like that talent is mine.
What I'm about to go to has nothing to do with marriage. That's the talent. Okay. That's where the talent is. I shared with you guys this story in Religion News. I got it from, I get the update daily from Real Clear Religion. You know how everybody will send you an email if you just sign up? And some of your emails are worth it. The Real Clear Religion is worth it. And they, you know, it's a list of religious stories. So they connected to this in Religion News. Does education cure people of faith? The data says no. And so we
is faith the disease here that you need to be cured of?
Well, they did put it in sneer quotes, cure, okay, you know, okay. Like the idea being that if you know, truly educated people move on from, you know, silly right. things like faith. And there's actually some empirical evidence that that is backwards. That is not true. That faith does not, unless you get a master's degree and don't go on to get the PhD. Which I don't know why people with master's degrees are so unfaithful. But
isn't this your experience?
No, I might have that backwards. If you go on to the, I think I said that backwards. So I got to take a break, but then we'll go through the actual numbers of the level of education that a person has related to the percentage of people in that group, that cohort, to use a very fancy word, that will say, I'm a nun. I have no faith at all. Do you think it's the PhDs or the I didn't graduate from high schools who have the least faith? Or is it somewhere in between? We'll find out when we come back. Flannel Panel, Thanksgiving show, right after this. The recent decision by the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade was a monumental victory for the pro-life movement. But the fight is far from over. With our new booklet, Why We're Pro-Life, we have produced the perfect tool to prepare you to have peaceful and convincing conversations to shed light on the truth about human life from conception to natural death. Catholic Answers is printing millions of copies of this booklet, and we plan simply to give them away. You can help us in two ways. First, by generously supporting this project. 25 cents prints one book. $2,500 prints 10,000, and so on. Second, by helping us distribute the booklet through your parish, your school, or the pro-life ministry you work with. Catholic Answers is going to blanket the country with Why We're Pro-Life, but only if you step up and help us. Thank you so much. For more information, visit whyweareprolife.com.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity in The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
What if the voice of your deepest doubts about Catholicism rose up in the form of a human being and challenged you to defend your most foundational beliefs? That's the task apologist Trent Horn took upon himself in his new book, Devil's Advocate, a dialogue with his own best objections against the faith that he professes and defends. You can stand up against your doubts, and Trent will show you how. Pick up your copy of Devil's Advocate today at shop.catholic.com or at a good Catholic bookstore near you. Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Every now and then we get the flannel panel together. It's Joe Heschmeyer, apologist here at Catholic Answers, wonderful writer and the host of Shameless Popery, and our president, Chris Check, and me, your host, Cy.
And I.
And I.
Thank you.
And
good
I.
Heavens.
And I.
English major. Here.
Wait. Oh, yeah, it is. Yeah, you're right. I'd lost track of the sentence.
I think I kind of had, too. I clearly had, but
that's one of my talents, correcting size grammar.
Me fail English? That's impossible.
I feel so insecure and sad right now. But thanks for that, for Thanksgiving Day. Okay, so where was I? I can't remember. Oh, yeah, flannel panel. I was describing the flannel panel. We get together. We correct each other's grammar. Joe gives us some what I think are puns, and Chris always corrects me and says it's wordplay and not a pun. So, but mostly we talk about the world, the news, whatever's going on from a Catholic perspective. One thing I didn't put on the list for you two was the German Synod, but they had a ad limina with Pope Francis. And if you want to talk about that later, we can. You want to add that to the list or not?
I mean, I could just say this. Pope Francis and those in the Vatican were like, maybe you could pause.
Yeah,
the synodal process,
and they were like,
"No, nah, we're not going to do that." Yeah, so that tells you everything you need to know. I mean, but it's worth saying because I think a lot of people think that the German bishop
running
interference for the Pope. But if so, they're doing it against these explicit instructions.
Yeah, yeah, that's a very good point. That I think that we in the United States have a skewed view of it, that the German bishops are basically bringing about the agenda that Pope Francis, I don't know, either secretly or not so secretly, is advocating. And that is clearly not the case.
Right, he's pushing against that.
Yeah.
And, you know, like some people have said, well, basically this gives him a lot of leeway because you have these dissidents on the left and then you have critics on the right, and it gives him a lot of, you know, basically lets him position himself in the middle, kind of the Overton window, if you're familiar with that idea, like the window of acceptable mainstream thought gets a little to the left and a little to the right based on who's the loudest voices.
Yeah.
But I think nevertheless, like it's worth saying what the German bishops are proposing is not what we've gotten any hint that the Holy Father wants. No.
A couple of years ago, according to Matthew Bunsen, and I've asked him for chapter and verse on this, and he hasn't gotten back to me yet, but if it's true, it's great. Even if it's not true, it's great. Apparently, the Holy Father wrote a letter to the German bishops and said, we've already had one Reformation in Germany. We don't need another one. So even if he never said it, he should have.
Yeah. Well, there was some Marine colonel, I can't remember his name, and somebody said to him, if you knew there was going to be a gunfight tomorrow, what gun would you bring? And this Marine colonel said, if I knew there was going to be a gunfight tomorrow, I wouldn't show up.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
And I say that because there was going to be this big showdown between Pope Francis and the German bishops, and everyone was like, oh, this Friday meeting is going to be the big showdown, and Pope Francis didn't show up. He let two Vatican cardinals handle it, which seemed – some people interpreted that as a snub of the German bishops. I think the German bishops tried to put the best face possible on it, but it really did seem to be a message. Like, this is not a meeting that I have to be at. Like, get your act together. That's the way it seemed to me.
You know who does that in a really spectacular way?
Who?
Our Lord. He sends St. Michael to beat the devil. And it's the best, like, not showing up for the meeting. Like, the Battle of Armageddon happens. And in our mind, it's like these two equal sides between Jesus and Satan. But if you read the actual text of Revelation, it's like St. Michael, you get an underling who's not even, like, one of the highest ranked of the angels, who then defeats the devil. Like, that's such a great snub.
Yeah.
And it's like him combined with, like, a Jewish teenage mom. Like, what a great, yeah, like, that is a great way to say, like, you think you're so great, but, like, we can take you out.
But I'm going to send my mom and a mid-level angel. Yeah.
I want to say, I think since then, St. Michael's probably had what we call
a
battlefield commission or battlefield promotion.
Yeah. Exactly.
Well, probably some decorations.
Well, I don't know, because we don't really know St. Michael's status among the angels, but there do seem to be very high angels who are entirely devoted to the worship of God and don't do anything else. They just worship God.
If Aquinas is right, when you've got the seven kind of choirs of angels, you got the seraphim and cherubim at the top, and the two lowest ranks are angels and archangels because they're messengers.
Yeah.
And so St. Michael's at the second lowest level. He's at the outward facing side of heaven, if you will. You know, he's doing external relations. He's the PR guy. You know, he's sending messages and
true now
handling
that
unpleasant meetings.
The 13th calls him
what?
Prince of the Heavenly Host.
Well, without question, but the Heavenly Host is an army.
Yeah.
You know, but there's whatever we might say about Michael, one thing we should remember about Michael is he is a being by nature incalculably higher than we are by nature.
Yes. I don't mean any of this to insult St. Michael in any way. Hopefully that's really clear. Only to say that I think God is showing the weakness of the devil by not handling that directly.
Yeah.
That he's showing something about being able to destroy the devil with his little pinky.
Yes. Yeah.
By sending angels to do it.
Yeah, I think the Pope not showing up for the meeting is quite a it's kind of a bad move. You know, it's like you don't need me for this. Deal with the dicasteries. That's the level that this should be dealt with.
When you say a bad mood, you mean like he's not, this is not a warm embrace.
Well, I was leaving a word out of that you can't say on the radio.
Oh, I see. I'm not from Boston.
It was a bad, you fill in the next word move. You see what I'm saying? Do you or not?
I do.
Do I have to say it on the air?
No.
Balaam.
Balaam's donkey. That's right. All right, I want to get to this story that we were talking about, that I was mentioning before in Religion News, which you can find at religionnews.com. And it's about education levels and the relationship to being a nun, and not a nun like Joe's aunt, Jane, or Aunt Jane. I don't know. Is that okay to say aunt, or do I have to say aunt? You're the official language.
I say aunt, but I think aunt's acceptable. If Jimmy were here, he would say aunt.
All right. So Joe's Auntie
We're
Jane.
We're from an aunt part of the country, so she's Aunt Jane. She's never Aunt Jane.
It is not that kind of nun, but the kind of nun that says,
N-O-N-E.
I ain't got no religion. And what do you think? Like, if you, these are the education levels. Some high school education, high school graduate, trade school graduate, some college, 2 years of college, 4 years of college, some graduate school, a master's degree or a doctorate. Like, I would honestly think that the worst category as far as faith would be the people with the doctorate. Like, that's just a kind of a prejudice I have. And it has nothing to do with, I don't think that that's because a higher education makes you less likely to believe. I think a higher education means you've been through ideological training through your bachelor's degree, your master's degree, and your doctorate. And most people don't have the strength to maintain their faith through all that ideology.
I suspect that's not...
Well, not only that, you're someone who chose. You paid money to undergo all of that.
Yeah.
So, like, even if you have the
self-selecting
strength, some people are going to say, I'm so tired of dealing with this stuff. I'm going to go somewhere else.
So I think there's an important piece of data here that's missing that would help us interpret the chart better. And it's this. First of all, this is problematic to begin with because it talks about education, and the people who are, you know, gathering these numbers have a different understanding of what education is and what I do, or what the three of us believe that it is. Nonetheless, they're talking about conferring degrees.
Degrees, yeah.
So my feeling, however, or my sense, and I don't know this, but my sense is that bachelor's degrees, master's degrees, and doctorates, we would tend to think that must be something in the liberal arts, like these are all English majors or something. And if it were broken down by field, I suspect we would find, most English majors are unaffiliated or something like that. But I think most degrees that are conferred nowadays are in science and engineering.
Yeah.
I think more than half. And so they are not, they're probably getting a little bit of the silliness in the core classes that they have to take at the undergraduate level. But most of these guys are just, you know, doing differential equations and heat transfer and stuff like that. I mean,
right. And it's much more destructive to the soul to be exposed to, like, deconstructionism, in your literature department than it is to be exposed to atoms and.
Yeah. So one thing that I think would give a little bit of color to this data is, How do degrees divide between, you know, when we were at Rice, we called science and engineering and academic, or, you know, the arts. And I think most of it's in science and engineering now, or business. That's not really a discipline, but, you know.
But wouldn't that be a weird kind of thing to, if that's the case, and I suspect that you are right about that, because many, many scientists and engineers are, in fact, people of faith.
Yeah.
They
appreciate the order of the universe.
Right. But the idea that the science, that there's some kind of conflict between science and faith is utterly refuted by that then.
Yeah.
But let me give the numbers, because actually people who did not graduate high school are the most likely of all of these groups to have no religious affiliation. People who have a doctorate there's four groups that are less faithful than they are. So they're not the best. So I actually read this backwards when I was saying it before we went to the break, but people with a master's degree are the most
least likely to be unaffiliated.
Least likely to be, the most likely to be affiliated with some religion.
No. Yeah, there's two bits of data that are, or two data that are in a bit of tension with each other. Because it is true that the more education you have, the less you describe yourself as believing in God without a doubt, the more likely you are to say you either don't believe or you don't have a way of finding out. So there is more of a crisis of belief among the more educated, but there's a crisis of, we might say, church participation or connection with any kind of organized religion among the less educated. That if you are someone who didn't graduate high school, the odds that you don't go to church or consider yourself a Christian are a lot higher, even though you're still likely to say that you believe in God in some way. So it was 61% of those at the lowest levels of education called themselves Christian. That's Protestants, Catholics, and those who call themselves just Christians. And at the highest level, rather those who've taken some graduate courses, it's 69%. So, yeah, it is higher. So you're more likely to be a Christian and more likely to be an atheist at the higher levels of education, which is kind of paradoxical in a way. But I think it points to a sort of social disenfranchisement. We talked about this, I think, in our last flannel panel, that you've got this whole crisis of young men, especially, who are unemployed and making no real efforts at finding employment, and they're not involved in their communities, and they're not involved in any kind of civic organization, and that they're clocking full-time job levels of hours in front of screens.
And so they're unaffiliated from life, not just from churches.
Exactly. They're unaffiliated. But so it's not that they have reached some profound conviction that there is no God. It's that even though they believe in God, they're so radically checked out from the world around us that it's a different kind of crisis in atheism, but it's one that in one way is harder to answer, right? If someone is an intellectually convicted atheist, you can say, let's go through these arguments. If someone is just too distracted to care, well, you've got a whole lot of work just to get into the argument in the first place.
Well, there's an element of despair also in that, and someone who's not completing high school, something else, there are other things, as you describe, Joe, at work that are causing him and or her not to graduate high school, and I think despair is probably a lot of it. I mean, everybody can finish high school.
Yeah, well, not everybody, but you're right. There's a way in which if you didn't finish high school, there's some in the United States now, as opposed to the United States 100 years ago.
Oh, sure, that's different.
There's some reason for that. That has to do with you, with maybe illness or mental illness or social difficulties or some other factor is there or criminal right. activity or something.
And all those things you would also expect to find in someone who's unaffiliated. One of the things that I found interesting about this data, and it might be the other chart that shows it better, is it tracks with some data that my old friend Alan Carlson, who I think is probably the best living historian or social historian on the family, recorded a number of years ago. And that is that in the around the time of the council, in the pre and post, just right before and right after the council, the most fertility among Catholic women, the highest fertility among Catholic women, was women with bachelor's degrees.
That's before the council.
Yeah, around the time of the council. Yeah, okay. I mean everything's. I mean, we've talked about this in the past of what we're going to blame on what, but there was a period when in American history when it was common for Catholic women to get bachelor's degrees, but this did not depress fertility. In fact, if you had a bachelor's degree, your fertility was likely to be higher than if you did not.
Can I suggest then that
I'm afraid to ask a stupid question. What causes your fertility to go up with a bachelor's degree?
Well, an enthusiastic embrace of the Catholic faith. I mean, that included not using contraceptions and that contraception. And at least that would be a guess. I don't know. I don't know the social science on it.
Yeah,
but
it
does seem like Catholic colleges were doing a better job of turning out faithful Catholics, 60, 70 years ago than they're doing now. I think that seems self-evident.
I think even a lot of Catholic colleges would probably, if pressed on that, acknowledge that they no longer consider that their mission or their mandate.
I mean, right, of course.
The Land O'Lakes Declaration in the late 60s, Notre Dame and a number of other Catholic colleges basically said, no, our mission is just to advance free thought. It's not to basically do what the church understands Catholic education to do. I'm oversimplifying there, but they really rejected the notion that they're an arm of the church in a meaningful way that are meant to help form people to be better Catholics.
I mean, think of places like Franciscan or Benedictine, for example, where the faith is so obvious the thing that informs the mission of the school. These places turn out female college graduates who marry and have a lot of children.
And men too, though.
Well, yeah, of course. Fertility is measured by women, in the population by women.
Right, but yeah.
I'm not the demographer. I didn't come up with that rule, but it makes sense.
But yeah, right. Yeah. But one thing to note about this chart.
I understand that one. You don't need to explain that.
The one thing that I do notice about this chart, and I have to take a break, so I'll just say it, and if you want to comment it, we can do it when we come back. But from third grade through doctorate, the most stable group as far as percentage of the population is Catholics. That evangelicals, Protestants, atheists, everybody goes up and down depending on education level. Catholics stay pretty stably about mid to lower 20%
of between 22-26%.
All the way through. It's a weird little phenomenon. I don't know if you want to comment on it, but if you're going to, you got to do it when we come back. We'll be right back with more Thanksgiving Day Flannel Panel on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
What a great grace it is to have the opportunity to use the airwaves for the honor and glory of God, to be able to talk to the hearts of individuals and meet them where they are in their relationship with our Lord, and also to encourage them forward.
Women of Grace with Johnette Williams, tomorrow morning, 11 a.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. Did either of you want to comment on that? Because move on.
I would.
All right.
Go ahead.
The point being that it does seem like through all education levels, there is a variability in among many of the designations, whether you're Protestant or Christian or agnostic or whatnot. There doesn't seem to be very much variation among Catholics. We stay between, as Chris said, between 22-26% of the population.
27. Interesting. The 27 there is middle school, and that would track probably with confirmation.
Oh yeah, that's right. I
think the consistency here, though, that we see with respect to Catholics in these different education level groups, where there's so much variance in non-Catholics, Protestants, non-believers, whatever it is, it is in large part a function of daily, or rather, at least weekly, liturgical life.
I can kind of give an anecdotal support for what you just said. I'm thinking about, I noticed this really acutely in my time in D.C. I went to daily mass. It was either in Chinatown or one of these churches. It was downtown D.C. Might have been Mary Mother of God, Our Lady of the Rosary, one of these. And I noticed there were a bunch of businessmen and women on their lunch hour. There were construction workers who'd been working outside who took a break to come in for mass. And there were homeless people, or apparently homeless people, who were there. I mean, it was a total cross section of the demographic of the city. Here comes everybody. And I mean, you see this in kind of any way you want to measure that. I was looking at another instance at one of these attempts to create a more liberal, inclusive Catholicism with like women's ordination. And I watched one of the liturgical events that they considered a mass. And it was basically all, I'd say maybe 2/3 old white women and about 1/3 old white men. And that was, if you compare that to like, just pull up the Archdiocese of Washington's vocations page and look at the first 10 priests on there. And it's actually much more diverse than this attempt to create a more diverse priesthood. Yeah. And so all of that is to say that, like, Catholicism, for all of the things we criticize, for all of the ways that we regularly fall short, and then I think we call out on this show, there's something there that's attractive to anyone and everyone of all walks of life. Yeah. And again, like, any way you measure it, you know, Mary Mother of God in Chinatown at that time had Mass in English, Latin, and Mandarin. It still has, I think, two of those Masses.
This is a demographic fact. Every other religion in some way or another is associated with a particular race or ethnicity or social class or region of the world.
I have to say, in American Protestantism know this, it's shocking and scandalous how divided by race American Protestantism
sure.
is. I mean, and I don't think I'm making news by saying that. And that is not the case. I mean, I'll tell you a little story. When I was in the 1980s, when I was in college, this new term multiculturalism came out, and everybody was talking about multiculturalism. And so when I had in a class multiculturalism explained to me, the immediate thought that I had, even as a 19-year-old or whatever I was in college, was that's my parish. Like, that's exactly what my parish is. You know, I grew up in a Southern California parish where there was lots of people from Asia, lots of people from the Pacific Islands, black people, although not as many where I grew up in Southern California, but there were black people, lots of Hispanic people, lots of white people, and people of every age, people of every profession. It felt to me like, well, this goal that everyone had suddenly agreed was the goal of everything, multiculturalism, had already been reached if you just went to church. But now I didn't know that that was particular to the Catholic Church, but that is one of the strengths of the Catholic faith is it really is everybody.
This contrast is especially striking alongside the schismatic Orthodox churches, which are
national churches in many ways.
Yeah, yeah.
No, they are ethnic
churches.
They're
ethnic churches.
Well, and then Dr. Martin Luther King said in 1963, it is appalling that the most segregated hour of Christian America is at 11 o'clock on Sunday morning. Mm-hmm. I love that description, we should not experience the most segregation in church. No. There's something deeply un-Catholic about that. And there's something deeply contrary to the make disciples of all nations kind of idea. And I think for all of their faults that the church has, and look, the Catholic Church in the U.S. has had deep problems with race and ethnicity.
Without question, Joe.
And yeah, a priest friend of mine from Louisiana had a wild story about this, about one of the priests who had tried to integrate the First Communions there, and he had received death threats. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to recommend this next part, but his way of resolving this is he processed down the aisle, and he had a .45 handgun, and he cocked it, and he loaded it, and he set it on the credence table. And he proceeded to celebrate Mass, and no one made a fuss.
Yeah, this is in the general instruction of the Roman Missal, isn't it? Somewhere?
Southern Rite.
I think 45 is too high a
the
caliber.
Southern Rite.
You're supposed to use a lower caliber in church. 45 is way too high for church. Because
it's
stained glass.
Dangerous to the.
But let me just. This reminds me of the
Can
story
we get this
of Father
guy on the show?
Augustus Tolton, who he's the first African American man that we know was ordained a Catholic priest for a ministry in the United States, and experienced tremendous racism in trying to become a priest in the United States. He goes over to be trained in Rome, and he realizes the church in Rome is not interested really in his race. There's priests from Africa there. There's priests from Asia. There's priests from all over being trained. I'm not saying that there's no racism in Rome. I don't know Roman people or Rome enough to know that. But I am saying
they hate everyone to the south of them, I assure you.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is that the Catholic Church itself really is universal. And we thank God for people like Father Tolton who saintly Father Tolton, really a saintly man.
And maybe if we could just say in one sentence, in these places we find racism, it's because we failed to be as Catholic as we ought to be.
Right.
Yeah, right. And the Catholic Church is just stuffed full of all kinds of races. And that's one of the great strengths of it. I don't know how we even ended up on that, but we got more Flannel Panel coming up for Thanksgiving Day. And we do give thanks for the great variety of color, of age, of race, of the human race that God has made. And we'll come back with more stuff to be thankful about, and frankly, some stuff not to be thankful about, because it's Flannel Panel. When we come back right after this, Catholic Answers Live.